So hello, everybody. Thanks for being here. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting all of us. It's been a great conference. Let me just say, I'm going to talk today about joint work with a lot of people. Much of this is a project that I worked on with Adrian Klinger, Chuck Duran, Jacob Lewis, and myself. And some of this has actually been written up. It appeared in the Groups and Symmetries conference proceedings, which came out in 2009. And then I hope, if we proceed rapidly enough, to give you just a little bit of a taste of some more recent work involving Hossein Movsadi. So our one technical difficulty is that I think my earpiece will fall off if I look up, and I'm short. So if you need a bit of suspense in this talk, you can just wait and see when that happens. Until then, let's let M be the lattice H plus E8 plus E8. Remember, E8 for us are going to be negative definite, and H is also known as U, depending on your preference. It's this lattice with 0, 1, 1, 0 intersection form. And let's just start by recalling some of the information about a family of K3 surfaces that we've seen several times before in the last couple of weeks. So we're looking at M-polarized K3 surfaces. That means that these have a primitive embedding of the lattice M into their Picard lattice. And we know that these surfaces possess a symplectic involution phi, so we can mod out by phi. And then if you take the resolution, the minimal resolution of that quotient space, what you get is another K3 surface, which is itself the Kummer product of two elliptic curves. So here, phi is a symplectic involution, sometimes called a Nikulin involution, but I hesitate to reserve only one type of involution to Nikulin. And then E1 and E2 are elliptic curves. So what do we know about these things? We know that generically, any M-polarized K3 surface will be Picard rank 18. 8 plus 8 plus 2 equals 18. We've guaranteed ourselves to have this much stuff in the Picard lattice, and usually you'd expect that that's all you get. However, Picard rank is not a nice continuous invariant. Picard rank can jump. It can jump, and it will jump as much as you let it, in this case up to 19. Or even 20. Now, this subject was in some sense started by Inese, who in 1978 studied the rank 20 case. These are the so-called singular K3 surfaces. And then you can ask yourself, okay, suppose I jump not all the way up to 20, because those are well understood, but jumping just up to a rank 19. If I'm already M-polarized, And I decide that I want to be an M-polarized K3, but with Picard rank 19. You can do a little bit of lattice math and say, okay, what does this lattice have to look like? It's got to be polarized by something which we'll call M sub N. It starts out being H plus E8 plus E8. But then we have to also add something that has square minus 2n. Now, the overreaching goal of this talk is going to be characterizing when does this happen. What are the M sub n polarized loci? And the way we're going to do it is we're going to use Picard-Fuchs equations. So I'm going to give you an actual differential equation that tells you when this happens. Okay. So I want to compute some differential equations. I'm going to need some kind of actual starting point, an actual model to work with. And the way I'd like to do it, first of all, to experiment with how many boards I can use. Okay. So let's realize our M-polarized K3 surfaces as singular cortex. Hoping that at this point we're all sort of expert in this equation. They'll take the form Q of A, B, and D, which is given by Y squared ZW minus 4X cubed Z plus 3, here's my A parameter, times X times Z times W squared plus B times Z times my W parameter minus 1/2 times dz squared w squared plus w to the fourth. And of course, I'm setting everything equal to zero. All right. Yes. So this family was studied by Klinger and Doran. They have some very nice results telling you all about it. The A, D, and D. Right. We haven't got the C yet. You'll see it if we go fast enough. My A, B, and D live in weighted projective 2, 3, 6. My D is a discriminant and it's not allowed to be 0. And let's see. What did Chuck and Adrian tell us? You should remember some of this from the introductory lectures if you were here. We know that we've got an invariant sigma, which is, you can think of as the J invariance of these two elliptic curves that show up in the Kummer. You take a nice symmetric sum. And another thing I can do if I've got two J invariants is I can take their product. But right here, this has nothing to do with this singular quartic. So we can also write sigma and pi in terms of the singular quartic. Sigma is going to be A cubed over D minus B squared over D plus 1. And pi is going to be A cubed over D. All right. Now, what I've got here is I've got my equation. It depends apparently on three parameters. Really more on two parameters, because I can use my weighted projective space to set any one of those parameters equal to a constant for some patch. But I'm looking for something that's rank 19, which means what I'm really looking for is I'm looking for something that's a one-parameter family. Oh, I should have kept my Q. So let's consider, let's take the same Q that we had before, But now let's just suppose that A and B and D all depend on some parameter T. And we'd like to compute the Picard-Fuchs equation. That's satisfied by the period of our holomorphic two form. So our 2-0 form, let's call it omega of t. So the period looks like the integral of omega of t. All right. Now here's what we'd like to do. And we need some way to compute Picard-Fuchs equations where A and B and D can be fairly arbitrary functions of T. So this is a situation where we're not going to be able to integrate this period as Duco did so amazingly in an earlier talk, because we don't know what A and B and D are. So we will resort to the good old Griffith-Storck method. And let me start by recalling for you Griffith-Storck as it's usually stated. And then we'll talk about some technicalities and refinements. So let's just remember how Griffith-Storck would work. If I were trying to compute an equation for some family of smooth hypersurfaces, and let's see, I already have an N in this talk, so maybe I should make that PM. All right. We'll assume that our family of smooth hypersurfaces is called Y of T, and they're given by a family of polynomials F of T. All right. Step number one is to try to get your hands on some forms. We'll write forms in H upper M minus 1 of Y of T as residues of meromorphic forms and these meromorphic forms will live in H upper M of Pn minus y of t. Okay, and let's push this up and write down formula thing. Pm. You're right. So symbolically, I'm going to have the residue of some polynomial times omega divided by f raised to some power. And this is going to live, if I've got my counting right, in h upper m minus k, k minus 1 of y. Here, p is a polynomial. The degree of p is going to be k times the degree of f minus m plus 1, and omega is the usual holomorphic form on Pm, and the sanity check you should do is if I take just omega divided by f, I should get something that is a holomorphic form if I'm working with a K3 or a Calabi-Yau. So once you've figured out how to write your form, you can start taking derivatives. And you have to do a lot of work, if you're being careful, to think about what it means to take a flat family of things to integrate over, and what it means to be doing differentiation. But once you've done that theoretical work, it looks like a problem you could give to your calculus students. or as I know, to your intensely brilliant undergraduate. So you can take the derivative of the integral of the residue of one of these forms, and this will be just the residue of omega. Doesn't depend on t at all, it's living in our ambient space, so I've just got omega times the derivative of p over f to the k. And of course, if you take p not to depend on t, that formula will get even simpler than it was already. Now here's the sort of big idea of why this works as an algorithm. You say to yourself, well, gosh, h upper m minus 1 of y of t, this is just some finite dimensional vector space. And because it's a finite dimensional vector space, if we take enough derivatives, will have some linear relation. And it will be not C linear, because we have this T dependence, it's going to be a C of T linear relation. And then finally, a computational note. Or, I guess, a semi-computational note. How would you actually do this? Well, if you take derivatives, the pole order, what power you're raising f to, is going to change. So you need to use a reduction of pole order formula. And what this does is it gives you a way to compare something that looks like the residue of p times omega divided by f to the k plus 1 to something else that looks like a residue of q times omega divided by f to the k. So here's our general Griffith-Stork algorithm, and let me now just make some comments about this. Okay. So let me first observe that, as I have stated this so far, if y is a k3, then h upper 2 of y with c coefficients is 22 dimensional. Or if you're being strictly careful, you can look at the image of the residue map. The image of the residue map is going to be the primitive cohomology. In other words, it's perpendicular to the hyperplane class. And so the primitive cohomology is 21 dimensional. And so all this really guarantees us is a 21st order ODE. Because we know that if we take 21 derivatives, and we also have our period where we didn't take any derivatives, then we definitely have some kind of linear relation. But I suspect that most of us in this room do not have the stamina to work with 21st order ODEs. And that's all right, because we can actually do better as long as we choose to work with things that have high Picard rank. So if y has high Picard rank, we can do a lot better. And the basic observation to make here is that the holomorphic form and its derivatives don't live anywhere they could possibly live. They're constrained to be orthogonal to the pick. Omega and its derivative are orthogonal to pick. So what I should really expect to find an ODE that has order of 22 minus rho. And what is rho? Rho is going to be the generic Picard rank of y. Okay. So that's observation number one. In this case, we're working with things that are Picard rank 18 or 19, so we should have a fairly low order differential equation. Next thing I want to do is talk just a little bit more about computing these things. Let's define a ring J of F. This is just the partials of my polynomial with respect to each of my variables. Yeah, the Jacobian ideal. You're quite right. I'll have a Jacobian ring in a second. Okay. And let's actually put this reduction of polar order formula that I mentioned earlier on the board. What does it say? It says that if I have something that looks like omega divided by f to the k plus 1 times the sum of some polynomials multiplied by partial of f with respect to xi, this is going to be equal to 1 over k times omega divided by f to the k times the sum over I of the derivatives of the a sub i's plus some exact terms. Right. Now, if you stare at this for a second, you'll see that on the left-hand side, you have stuff that manifestly belongs to the Jacobian ideal. And in other words, when we can reduce a polar order is precisely when I'm working with things that live inside the Jacobian ideal. So if we're in the Jacobian ideal, we're going to reduce the polar order. Now I've got an ideal. I've got an ideal living in an ambient ring, which we'll call S. We're just going to adjoin all of our variables. And then S, of course, is graded by degrees of monomials, and the grading on S induces some kind of grading on my genuine Jacobian ring, which we'll call R of F, just the quotient of S by my beautiful Jacobian ideal. And we've got maps.
Sorry.
What is the variable T? Right, so strictly speaking, I should be taking C parentheses T, X naught, la la la, XN. Or if I had a multi-parameter family, C parentheses however many. It depends on whether you want to think about the primitive cohomology of one of these things at a time or whether you want to think about it as a family. Right. Right. Okay. So where we are is we've got injected maps. I'm going to take this ring R of F. I'm going to take the part of it that has degree k times the degree of f minus m plus 1. It goes into h upper m minus k, k plus 1 of y. Here k starts counting at 1, 2, etc. And again, this should be saying to you that if I take a constant, it should be mapping into a holomorphic form if I'm working with a K3 or a Calabi-Yau. And not only do we have an injective map in this nice way, the image here is the primitive cohomology. And let me just remark parenthetically that if you're trying to generalize this technique to something in toric varieties, the injectivity may fail, and so that's the one thing you would have to worry about. But so far we've been talking about smooth things, and you'll notice that now I've turned this whole thing into some kind of computation in a nice friendly ring, and since I've turned the whole thing into some kind of computation of a nice friendly ring, your favorite computer algebra system will help let us compute in R of F. So in practical terms, what you need in order to do a Griffith-Stork computation is you need something that can tell you when a polynomial lived in the ideal J, or equivalently when it vanishes in our ring R of F. I recommend Magma. It's kind of expensive, but it is fast. And now, here's an objection that I almost expected someone to have made already. Here I've been telling you all of this stuff about how to do Griffith-Stork for smooth hypersurfaces, but I don't have any smooth hypersurfaces. What I've got are quartics Q that depend on A of T and B of T and D of T, and they just so happen to have ADE singularities. So this is something that you should probably be concerned about, but fortunately it doesn't disrupt us too much. First of all, we're working with surfaces with ADE singularities. The residue map is still going to be well-defined. If we've got a form that's defined everywhere except around the regulations of the resolutions of our singularity, we can extend it. So that's all right. Furthermore, if I decided to resolve my singularities and throw in some more elements of my cohomology, what I'd be doing is I'd be throwing in more elements of the Picard group. And that means that omega and its derivatives, they're still going to be orthogonal to whatever I get, to whatever elements of pick I introduce by resolving my singularities. And everything I've said so far is sort of general for things with ADE singularities, but there are actually some nice results of Steenbrink that apply specifically in the surface case. So in 07, Steenbrink wrote this paper, which implies that the dimensions of all of these graded pieces of the ring R of Q are exactly what you would expect them to be. In other words, the dimension of the degree zero part is going to be 1, the dimension of the degree 4 part is going to be 19, and the dimension of the degree 8 part is going to be 1. Therefore, the moral of the story is I can get away with just doing computations in my ring R of Q, even though Q happens to be a singular quartic. Okay, so I've established that I can do this, so let me do it. Or let me announce that once upon a time I did it in my youth. Right. So, thus we may use the Griffith-Storck algorithm, and we obtain a fourth order ODE, which I'm not going to write on the board because remember I took general A and B and D, and so all of my coefficients are going to involve A and B and D and their derivatives of various sorts, and T is the variable. So A and B and D are all functions. And so, no, I don't. Right, I have a lot of coefficients. That's why I'm not writing this thing down. It would take me the rest of my talk. I compute with generic coefficients. All right. And sanity check, we... rational function. No, if you think of T as just living in C, A and B and D can be any rational functions you like. Okay. So I don't want to write down my whole ODE, but I do want to write down some of it. And somehow A and B and D and derivatives thereof. B, B prime, A double prime, C double prime. Right. So, but let's rewrite the whole thing in terms of J1 and J2. Because maybe that's more illuminating. We'll take J1 of T and J2 of T, and we'll take them to be just any functions of some complex parameter C. And what do we need? We'll have our sigma now of T, which will be their sum. And we'll have our pi of T, which will be their product. And we need these things to be rational. Because we can use our formulas that we had on the board at the beginning. If we know sigma and pi, we can recover A and B and D. Then let's rewrite our Picard fifth equation in terms of these J's. And when we rewrite in terms of J1 and J2, and of course all of their derivatives, then we can write down the coefficient of the fourth derivative. And let's see. This isn't quite huge enough to require me to reveal it. But I think I might want a full column. Okay. So we want to look at the coefficient of the fourth derivative of the period. And let's see. I've got a 144 out front. Then I've got J1 of t minus 1 multiplied by J2 of t minus 1. I cube that. Then I take the product of J1 of t and J2 of t. And I raise that to the fourth power. And once I've done that, I take the difference of J1 of t and J2 of t, and I raise that to the seventh power, and then I have some derivatives. So I take J1 prime of t and J2 prime of t, and those I square, and I'm still not done yet. I'm actually just getting to the interesting part. All of this is multiplied by an operator box J2 of t, so box of J2 of t minus box of J1 of t. And what is this operator box? Take a deep breath to stretch my hand out. Box of J of t is given by J prime of t squared times 36 J of t squared minus 41 J of t plus 32 divided by 144 times J of t minus 1 squared times J of t squared plus 1/2 times a Schwarzian derivative of J of t and t. All right. Is there a parenthesis missing in the top numerator? After the J prime of t squared, I totally believe you that there is. And I suppose for those of us who were not raised to know these things, I should just tell you what the Schwarzian derivative is, too. So the Schwarzian derivative, bracket J of t and t, is just this derivative thing. We've got 2 J prime of t times J triple prime of t minus 3 times, I hope I haven't typoed my number of primes, but I think it's J triple prime of t divided by 2 J prime of t squared. And the key thing about this is that it's in a quantity that's invariant under linear fractional transformations. Okay. We've got this whole big formula, and now we can ask ourselves, when does this coefficient of the fourth derivative vanish? My short thing is wrong. Do you want to tell me how to fix it? J double prime here or here? On the left? I knew that had to be the other left? Make the whole thing. Got it. So I want to ask, when does this coefficient vanish? And let me again pull something down so we can write a long list. So the easy way to make it vanish is to look at the equation that I have on the top board and just say, all right, if one of those factors is equal to zero, then of course it'll vanish. So it could happen if J1 or J2 is a constant. It could happen if J1 of t equals J2 of t. And it could also happen if box of J1 of t equals box of J2 of t. Of course, this last, the idea that box of J1 equals box of J2, that's the one that you wouldn't have predicted coming in. So here's one way of saying when the coefficient should vanish. But another way of saying when the coefficient should vanish is, okay, I had a fourth order ODE. If it drops to a third order ODE, that's telling me that I'm really working with something that's Picard rank 19. So equivalently, you could say it happens if Q of t corresponds to a family and this X of t is a family of rank 19 and M sub n polarized K3 surfaces. So you know that if you've got a rank 19 polarized K3, it has to have an order 3 ODE.
Yes, but
we looked for that. Okay. So we have the idea in terms of differential equations. We have the idea in terms of our K3s. How else could we do it? We could also say, all right, well, if I have rank 19, that's the same as saying something about this, the Coomer that we're working with. So each of these K3s, X of T, it should correspond via the Shiota-Inese structure to a pair of elliptic curves that have something to do with each other. So you've got this pair of elliptic curves, E1, E2, and they have some kind of relationship between them. What is this relationship between them? It's an N-isogeny. The easy one, of course, is if J1 is exactly equal to J2. Or we could have a more general isogeny structure. And then when this happens, you can actually say, where's the extra algebraic cycle on my K3 coming from? The extra algebraic cycle on my K3 is going to correspond to the graph of the N-isogeny. So if you like, you can think about this computation as telling you how to detect isogenies of elliptic curves. Let's write that down as a theorem. is where a big theorem from the 09 paper. So let's suppose we have any J1 of t and J2 of t. And let's assume they're non-constant, so we're out of the boring case. Non-constant functions of t. And again, we have to assume that their sum and product are rational. Then, what have we got? Then we know that box J1 of t is going to equal box J2 of t. Call this equation star. This will happen if and only if J1 of t and J2 of t is a parameterization, possibly a local parameterization. I'm only taking a patch here. Of some modular curve. So because of this, because the box J1 equals box J2 actually is a differential geometric way of detecting modular curves, we call this the master equation. N is the same N. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it still follows. You just have to work a little bit harder to justify what ring you're thinking about everything in. So let me break some chalk. And say what I said before, namely that we're excited about this equation, so we call it the master equation. Okay. And let's see. I've got just a minute or so left, or maybe a little more, depending on when you want to end. So let me just comment that there are ways to generalize this story. For instance, instead of considering the M-polarized family, you can consider the N-polarized family. This is the family that's polarized now by H plus E8 plus E7. Which has been studied by Klinger and Doran, and which you should also have heard a talk by Kumar about earlier in this conference. And I'll put the equation on the board just for everyone who was missing the C. This is y squared zw minus 4x cubed z plus 3ax zw squared plus bzw cubed plus cxz squared w minus 1/2 times dv squared w squared plus w to the fourth. So here's where the c is. You just didn't need the c for the m-polarized. It shows up when you work with the n-polarized. And you can play the same kind of game that we played earlier. So what happens in this case? First of all, we can compute the general Sicard-Fuchs equations. I should say that this is the part that I advertised was work also with Movistati. And now if you compute these, they're going to be a system of PDEs. And you can ask yourself, as before, okay, I've got this system of things, but what happens if I take a more special structure? And what you're particularly interested in is you're particularly interested in two-parameter now subfamilies. Yeah, it's equal to zero. Okay. So what happens if I look at a general two-parameter subfamily? Now I get a pair of equations. I get a second order and a third order PDE. And if you give me something that's special in this moduli space, for instance, if you give me a parameterization of a Humbert surface, then you can say, okay, what happens in that case? And what happens is that one of these third-order PDEs becomes a second-order PDE. So this is actually a way to detect in a differential geometric manner Humbert surfaces. And so let me just write that down, that the equivalent of the master equation is something that you can use to characterize Humbert surfaces. So I think I will stop there and ask for questions.